from Genesis 14. This is part 16 of our lessons in Genesis. So we'll get through chapter 14 this evening. And we'll just start off with a little comment about God and His sovereignty over the events of men throughout history, because that really is what chapter 14 deals with, and we need to keep that in mind as we read the events of chapter 14. You know, in different places throughout the Bible, you read the events that go on, and there's places in the Bible where, of course, the events have spiritual meaning, but they're secular events that go on, and they're reported in the Bible as has to do with those folks that as it affects those folks that surround the nation of Israel. And of course, in this case, we're dealing with Abram, the father of the nation of Israel. So I just want to make the point that in all cases, God is sovereign in the events of men and has control over the events of men when He wants to. And the Bible makes that clear. If you look at Daniel chapter 2, in verse 21, and He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. You know, we often think that the leaders of nations are there because of man's doing, and obviously those who are the leaders of nations think that they are the ones who are there because they deserve to be there. But the fact of the matter is, God puts them there for His purpose and His glory to play. You know, whether they're good leaders or bad leaders, they're there to accommodate His greater purpose and His plan. So, and He'll remove them in the same way to accommodate, you know, His purpose. So, and how God accomplishes His purpose is foreknown to Him and Him alone. And for us to second guess God, of course, is obviously a mistake. Proverbs chapter 21, verse 1, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, He turneth it whithersoever He will. So, you know, the leaders of nations and the leaders of men, they do things because they think that they're, it's their will, but in fact, oftentimes God changes their minds and God directs them to do things. You know, prophecy says that God is going to one day put His hook in the mouth of the leaders of the northern kingdoms and bring them against Jerusalem, you know, and it's going to be, they're going to think that it's their will to do that, but in fact, it's going to be God bringing those kings, you know, those leaders and their armies to play out God's will. So, you know, God accomplishes His purpose and His will in His own ways, and for, like I say, for us to second guess Him and His will and His purpose is certainly a mistake, because as we're going to find out in this chapter, all heaven and earth are His. They belong to Him, and we're just tenants. We're just here, and He created us, and when we pretend to be God, again, we've made a terrible mistake. So here in Genesis chapter 14, again, this is a secular event, but it ends up with a very spiritual lesson. So we I'll report the secular event, and what happens is there are nations involved, there's kings involved, and of course it ends up in a war, and this is a war in the Middle East. Now, I made a mistake and made one map. So, for those of you here, now for those of you who aren't here, for those of you who are online, the area that you're dealing with is from the Persian Gulf over to the Mediterranean Sea, And that would include, of course, like Saudi Arabia over to what is now Israel and down to around the corner to Egypt. And of course, there's all desert in between there. If you go north of the Persian Gulf, of course, you run into Iran and Iraq, modern-day Iran and Iraq. You take a left turn, you follow the Tigris and Euphrates River. That, of course, is the fertile delta up through there. You take a left, and then you go south. That forms the fertile, what's called the Fertile Crescent. Then you go south, and you come down through Syria, Lebanon, Israel. That you have the West Bank, of course, and Gaza. And sooner or later, you come into Egypt. That is the area of that we're dealing with. That's Abram first started out in Ur, which, of course, is just north of the Persian Gulf, almost down there at the confluence of the Persian Gulf, where the Euphrates River flows into it, and went north and into the very southern tip of Turkey and northern part of Syria, then came down into took a left and came south down through the Fertile Crescent and along the what would be the like the Dead Sea there, and into over to Egypt, and then came back. Meanwhile, so you get the idea of the area here. And that's the area that we're dealing with at the moment. Sodom and Gomorrah, located at the very southern tip of what is the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, and Mesopotamia, of course, that's the region over there between the Tigris and Euphrates River, Babylon, those areas over there. So that's what you have, and that's the area that you're dealing with. So if for those of you who are here, there's the Tigris and Euphrates, comes up through here. You follow along, and here's the areas where Babylon's over here. You have Sodom, Gomorrah, the area over here. Egypt, of course, is right off the page over here. And travel route goes up along the rivers and then down this way. No one goes across the desert because there's no water. You die out here in the desert. This is Saudi Arabia. So everybody would follow the river passageways, and that's the route of travel. So Elam. There's four Confederate Mesopotamian kings, and they are located over here between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in Mesopotamia. Okay, just to make this all make sense to you, that's Genesis 14:1. Elam, by the way, is modern Iran. That's the dominant power. Shinar is the region of Babylonia. If you read Zechariah chapter 5, you can read about Shinar and the flying roll and all that with the stork women landing the flying roll in Shinar. Meanwhile, and you find out in Genesis chapter 10:10, that the land of Shinar is where the Tower of Babel was. So that evil empire there was in the land of Shinar. Meanwhile, Genesis 14:1. So there's your geography lesson. So it makes sense to you. That's the important part. It has to make sense to you. If this all happened in the United States, we could talk about Ohio and California, but it's not. It's over there in the Middle East. So it came to pass, Genesis 14:1. And I'm going to butcher these names, I'm certain of it. I practiced them earlier in the day, but now I'm going to forget them. And it came to pass in the days of Amphrael, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Shetar-Laomar, and I'm going to have to say that about a half a dozen times or more, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. So there's four kings, and they are all confederate, one with another. In other words, they're in a group together. And there are five southern kings. And so the four confederate kings are over here. The five southern kings that are confederate with each other are over here, near Sodom and Gomorrah, down at the south end of what the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea, as it south of Jerusalem. That these verse 2 made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shember, king of Zeboam, and the king of Beler, which is Zoar. So all those places are located down here. Now, what's important here is this. If you notice the route, when you come down this way, this is a land bridge. So it's a trade route. And this all comes down to economics, money. Here's Egypt. And Egypt, of course, is a world power. And it's important. And if Egypt wants to trade with these guys, with the Babylonians, which is an important city, they don't go across the desert because people die out there in the desert. So they follow this established trade route, and I'll show you the established trade route here in a minute in the Bible. But they go up through this way here. Well, these guys down here are on this established trade route, so they have this power. It's sort of like our friend Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he is over in the Persian Gulf region, is he not? In the Straits of Hormuz, you've heard of the Straits of Hormuz. That's a 17-mile wide region of water where the Persian Gulf narrows down, and all the oil that's shipped from the Middle East goes through the Straits of Hormuz. Well, it's a trade route, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has threatened to close the Straits of Hormuz with his ships and his guns and all that, and cut off the oil, the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz. That's down here, off my little piece of paper, and so cut off the trade of oil to the rest of the world. And that in modern day times. Well, this is the same way, but of course this is not modern day times back then. But these guys here, they're in a position to cut off the trade between Egypt and Babylon, and that was the issue. So they went to war, and so they would have controlled what was called the King's Highway. Turn to in your Bibles to Numbers, the book of Numbers. Chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. And I'm going to turn there too. Here we have Numbers. That's not the most used part of my Bible. But here in Numbers chapter 20, verse 17, it says, "Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country." This is Israel going through Edom. "Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through the fields or through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand nor the left hand until we have passed thy borders." The king's highway was the established trade route. It was a road. The king's highway. Again, in chapter 21, verse 22, it's mentioned. it's mentioned again there. "Let me pass through thy land. We will not turn into the fields or into the vineyards. We will not drink the waters as well. We'll go along by the king's highway until we pass by thy borders." And that's what it was. It was the king's highway. And this was an established road. That's how the king's highway is how Abram originally took his route down into Egypt. I mean, he didn't go through creeks and over a bunch of rocky hills and everything. He took the road. I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to go from one place to another, if there's a road there, wouldn't you take the road from me? I would too, yeah. And that's how Abram got there. Well, guess what? These guys are in a position, these five kings are in a position, as you can see from this map. Here's here's Gomorrah here, there's Sodom right there, and there's Zoar right there, and here's the Amalekites, here's the Amorites. They're in a position to cut off this king's highway that runs right down through here into Egypt. Well, what's the issue, you say? Why would they do this? Well, it's because these five kings, first of all, they massed together in the Valley of Siddim. Now, that was at the south end of this Dead Sea right here. They massed together. They got all their armies together. Verse 3, all these were joined together in the Vale of Siddim. The Valley of Siddim is what that is, which is the Salt Sea. So they all joined their forces together, massed together, and said, we're going to cut off the trade route. And that's what they did. So, and the issue was, they were subservient to this one king who had the other three kings also allied with him. And of course, that was Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam. He was the head king. He was the big cheese in the region. And verse 4, 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. So they were like vassals to him. And they got tired of that. And so that was the issue. They decided they wanted to be rid of their subservience to him, and they were going to cut off the trade route until they got their freedom, basically. And so that really teed off Chedorlaomer. He collected up his allies and went down there to fight him. Well, so that's exactly what happened. Chedorlaomer, he got his three allied kings, and he went down to the region to because the trade was being cut off, and he took the established route. He went up the Tigris and Euphrates, he went up north and then came down south, and on his way down through there, he didn't immediately go to the Valley of Siddim, which is where those five kings were amassed together. Rather, on his way, he encountered resistance from other people that were also not so happy to be vassals, and so he wiped them out before he got to those five kings, and that's what verse 5 and 6 says. And so he kills everybody that he encounters. It says, in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him. So the four kings together, and he smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Canarim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and the Enims in Sheveth, Kirtharim, and the Horites in Mount Seir, unto Elparan, which is in the wilderness. That would be actually on this side over here. He was coming down this side, which would be the east side of the Dead Sea, because Mount Seir is over here on the east side. So he was coming down not the king's highway, but he was coming down the east side of the Dead Sea. So then he doubled back. Then he doubles back, and he sacks the Amalekites and the Amorites. So he comes down and around, and the Amalekites and the Amorites are over on the west side. So he's wiping out all the smaller armies and the smaller people that could reinforce these five kings before he attacks the five kings that have amassed together. Kind of a smart strategy. So, and they returned and came to Mishpat, I think I'm saying that right, which is Kadesh, and smote all in the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that dwell in Hazes. There's too many consonants in this. Hazes Tamar. And so, meanwhile, that's exactly what he did. He came. He swung around the south end, came up to the west side over here, so south of Gomorrah, and nailed the Amalekites and the Amorites. Then he joins the five rebel kings in battle. And that here on the south end, thank you, Betty, I'm doing very well with these names, yeah. Say that to anybody who actually was there. He joins the five kings, so there's going to be nine kings all together at the very south end of the Dead Sea, which is called the Salt Sea. And they're all in this valley of Siddim. And that's where this great battle's going to, supposedly great battle's going to take place. So here in verse 8, and then went out the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Shedaleamar, the king of Elam, and the and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amphirol, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings with five. Now, things must not have gone so very well for the five kings. So the forces of the rebels, which were the five kings of the south, things must not have gone too well, because what happens then is they their forces begin to fall, and the five kings flee the battle. And so you see in verse 10, in the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. And fell there. Now they did not fall. In other words, they weren't killed. But Sodom and Gomorrah fell, and they that remained fled to the mountain. So the people, the kings fled to the mountains. The people fled to the mountains. All the forces scattered. I mean, it was mayhem, and. So Sodom and Gomorrah are sacked, and any of the people that stayed behind that didn't flee in the cities were taken hostage, along with all the goods that were still in the city. And so those four kings took, you know, basically got everything in the city, plus all the people that had not escaped, took them all for hostage. And verse 11 and 12, and they, the four kings, took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So now, what do we find out here? Last we heard of Lot, where was he? He was living. He had moved in the valley toward Sodom. He was living in a small town outside of Sodom, in that beautiful valley that he had picked, because Abram had said, "Well, look around, and which way do you want to go? I'll give you your choice, because you know we've got too many herds and too many people, and we need to split up." And Lot looks around and says, "Boy, that looks really nice over there. I'll take that." And it was, of course, in the direction of Sodom, and so he went that way. Well, and then he moves into one of the little towns. And he did that for his own purpose, didn't he? Because he thought to himself, it's going to be better for me economically. I'll prosper because, first of all, the grass is greener. Second of all, I'm going to be in the city, and you know, I'll be able to sell my goods. I'll prosper, and you know, it'll be money in my pocket. And what he did was he left Abram with, well, the grass is the color of this carpet, to feed his flocks with. Well, all Abram was trying to do was to keep the peace, but Abram didn't. You know, gripe and moan. He said, "Fine, you take that, and I'll go the other direction." And he did. And God reassured him that everything, you know, he said that the Lord came to Abram and he said, look everywhere. And this is how chapter 13 ended. Look everywhere. It says, the land which thou seest, I'll give it to you for thy seed forever. And I'll make thy seed as the dust of the earth. So if a man can number the dust of the earth, then your seed will also be numbered. You know, and he renewed his promise to Abraham. And so Abraham, you know, built an altar there, and he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron. Well, just, you know, not the fertile ground, not the prime lot for, you know, raising sheep. It's not near a town. Well, so last we find Lot, he was near Sodom, but he wasn't in Sodom. Well, all of a sudden now we find him living in Sodom, because he gets captured when Sodom falls. So he is doing exactly what God said not to do. Remember, what did God tell Abram to do when God first approached Abram? Remember chapter 12, now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and away from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. He said, get away from all these people. And I'll show you a land that I'm going to give you, and I'm going to bless you and bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. You know, and trust me. Don't trust yourself. And Lot does exactly the opposite. He goes right back to you know, relying on himself, relying on, you know, moving back in with you know, the sinners and the enemies and yeah. So now he's carried away with those who ransack Sodom. Well, Abram is living in the plain of Mamre. And relatives of Abram's neighbors had been taken captive. And they also inform Abram that Lot was taken captive when Sodom fell. Now, we find out that this is the first time that the term Hebrew is used. Look at Genesis chapter 14 and verse 13 and 14. There came one that had escaped. So somebody had escaped from Sodom when the city fell, and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite. That was, that of course, Abram was dwelling in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. Now, what does that mean? It means that Abram was well known as a Hebrew. He had made a name for himself, hadn't he? And not just any name. He was known as being different from the rest of the population. He was a Hebrew. Well, what does that mean? It means something different than the rest of the people. I mean, you know, how many other Hebrews were there? None, as far as I know. This is the first person in the Bible to be called a Hebrew. This is Abram the Hebrew. And once somebody has escaped, and he runs to Abram the Hebrew. And Abram the Hebrew had made peace with an Amorite, Mamre the Amorite, because he dwelt there in that plain. He was the brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and those two were confederate. They were friends with Abram. So he had made peace with those, even though they weren't worshipers of the one true God. And when Abram heard that his brother, now Lot is called his brother. Why is he called his brother? Well, Mike's my brother. Thurman's my brother. They're brothers in faith. And Lot was Abram's brother in faith. That's why. So it's talking about his brother. And when Abram heard that his brother, Lot, was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house. How many? 318, and pursued them unto Dan. Now, you got to think about that. Where did he get the 318? Well, 318 had been born in his house. That's a lot of people, isn't it, that were born in his house. So you got to think there was more than just 318 that were there, because those are the ones that were born in his house. Where did all these come from? Well, remember how many that did he get with from Pharaoh? Remember the servants that came with him from Pharaoh, and all the riches that came with him from Pharaoh, and the people that came with him. You know, so there's a lot of wealth that he's been gaining over the years. So years have gone by, and there's a population explosion going on around Abram. None of them his descendants, but in his house there's a population explosion going on. So he takes 318 and of his own servants and pursues them unto Dan. Plus, by the way, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, because they also have a skin in the game, because they're his friends. Now you think about this. They have 322 people. That's by my count. 318 plus Abram plus the three friends. There's 322 people. He's taken 322 people against an army. An army. You have Chedorlaomer, who just moved like a tank through this whole region and town to town to town to town and just wiped out people left and right, plus just came up against five kings and decimated their forces. Abram's taking 322 people and thinking, oh, we can do this. I wonder what his wife Sarah said. What in the world are you thinking? You know. And for Lot, who gave you the short end of the stick, who moved to Sodom and really is getting what he deserved for disobeying God in the first place. Well, Moses doesn't write the reason why Abram is going to do what he's going to do. But it very well could have been faith. Again, I would remind you that chapter 13, which is the close of chapter 13, God renews his promise and to Abram, and that may have given Abram the faith needed to do what he's doing, reminding Abram that all the land will be his and his seeds. So Abram may have realized that God was with him in whatever he did. Abram also seems to have somewhat of a military mind. He gets there verse 15. You read, and he divided himself against them. He and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. Now, if you look at the little map here, right up here, pursued them all the way up to here. This is where down here is Gomorrah, and he pursued them all the way up to here, and that's where he finally caught them and smote them. Down here, down in this region is where he is living. Down in this region here. So,
is that the area that would be called Jerusalem?
Jerusalem would be in this area right here. Mm-hmm. So up here is
Damascus.
Yeah. And that's Syria. That's right. So then, verse 16, Abram brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot and his goods, and the women also, and all the people. So he recovered all the lost goods and all the people that were taken captive, and brought them back. Now, I've always said that the greatest test of a man's character is what he does when no one's watching. Another one of the greatest tests of a man's character is when he's successful in what he does. Proverbs 27:21 says, "As the fining pot for silver and the furnace for gold, so is a man to his praise." So Abram returns victorious from the battle, and he returns to what would be very similar to a hero's welcome. And he has in tow all the people that have been captured from Sodom, and all the spoils that had been taken from the cities. And so, you know, he's got a tremendous amount of victuals and spoils and goods and people and everything. I mean, he's got a parade behind him. And, you know, so you can just imagine. I mean, these, you know, in modern times, it would have been a ticker tape parade given for him. You know, in back in ancient Greece or Rome, you can imagine the victorious general coming in and, you know, riding in a chariot and everybody cheering as he led the army, you know, the victorious army back in, and all the slaves in tow and all the gold and silver. And that would have been, you know, that would have been Abram coming back, you know, home. Well, here comes the five rebel generals that had run, left the battle in the heat of battle. And here they come out to greet Abram as he's returning. In verse 17, the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is at the king's dale. And suddenly, out of nowhere, the king of Salem appears. And I mean out of nowhere. He hasn't been mentioned before. He isn't mentioned afterwards. But just out of nowhere, here comes Melchizedek, the king of Salem. And this is before the king of Sodom can speak, say, or do anything. Melchizedek comes to Abram, and this with a message. And the message is a reminder to Abram. As if Melchizedek, the king of Salem, knows exactly what the king of Sodom is going to say. And before he can say it, is going to remind Abram of something very important that Abram needs to remember. in verse 18, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. Now it's interesting that nothing more is said by Moses about Melchizedek, king of Salem, other than the historical appearance and what he says to Abram. There's no hint about who he is, where he came from, where he went to, why he was there. Nothing more is said about it by Moses. But the truth of Melchizedek is revealed later in the Bible. So it's profitable for us to understand who Melchizedek is and to realize who Melchizedek is and to realize that Abraham had to have known who Melchizedek was. Psalm 10, or 110, verse 4 says, "The Lord has sworn and will not repent. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." But the author of Hebrews goes much further. In chapter 7, verse 1 through 3, the author of Hebrews says, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually." So the author of Hebrews goes much further in explaining who the king of Salem really was. And whether Abraham fully understood who the king of Salem was or not, again, Moses does not say. Whether Moses fully understood who the king of Salem was is not understood, but it is fully said in the Psalms and completely explained in the book of Hebrews. But the priest, the king of Salem, reminds Abram that he is blessed by God. Who can do with heaven and earth what he wants? Yes, sir.
I think Salem means peace.
It is. The king, yes.
King of peace.
Yeah, that's what the author of Hebrews says, which by interpretation, okay. Which is king of peace. That's exactly right.
Okay, I was just thinking that puts a lot more.
Yeah.
This is what Salem does to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's in verse 2, Hebrews 7, 2. So the interpretation of king of Salem, which is king of peace. Yeah, exactly right. So, Melchizedek reminds Abram, that God owns heaven and earth. That's why I wanted to start the lesson how I did. That God is ultimately in control and is sovereign over the events of man. And whether we think about it in our daily lives or not, whether we want to believe it or not, God is God and He is in control of all things. He's in control of heaven, He's in control of earth, and He is the Most High God. And that is what Melchizedek reminds Abraham. He says, And Melchizedek blessed Abraham and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." And Melchizedek blessed also the Most High God, which gave Abraham the victory. As a reminder that Abram was not responsible for his own success. He took 322 men and defeated an entire army. I mean, against all odds. And Melchizedek wanted to remind Abram before the king of Sodom spoke that it was not his doing. Abram also then pays tithes of all the recovered spoils of the victory. You read in verse 20, "And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hand." And he gave him tithes of all. So Abraham paid him a tenth of all that was recovered from the battle. You read in Hebrews 7:4. Abraham wasn't home yet. He was on his way. And so, did he pay him a tenth of everything he had? No, he paid him a tenth of all that he had recovered from the spoils of the battle. The author of Hebrews in chapter 7, verse 4 says, "Now consider how great this man was, that Melchizedek, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils." So everything that Abraham had recovered in spoils from the battle, Abraham gave a tenth to Melchizedek, paid him a tithe of it. Whether it was from Lot's property or didn't make any difference whose it was, he gave him a tenth of everything that was recovered. In view of the king of Salem, or the king of Sodom, and this, I mean, some of the stuff was the king of Sodom's recovered property, I'm sure.
Apparently, imagine that was a commercial use when a guy had a devil on one shoulder and an angel on
the other. A devil on one shoulder and an angel, and they're arguing back and forth. That's right.
Trying to get his affections.
That's right.
Abram has been successful, and with success, you can have a whole lot of pride.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that really is the issue. Is with success comes with success comes, you know, the issue of who's responsible ultimately for that success. You know, Paul dealt with that in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. That, you know, if I'm going to glory, I'm going to glory in the Lord. You know, it's not my glory, it's all God's glory.
Sure.
For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. It's because God can work through me. So, ultimately, we find out, not from Moses, but from the author of Hebrews, that this man, Melchizedek, and he was a man, he was, it's funny how throughout the Bible, God uses the agency of men to work miraculous things. And the help comes from other men. So we can't, oftentimes we look for a miracle to happen, in desperate times, and we think, Lord, if only some kind of miracle would happen, or some fantastic thing. Jesus walked on the water. He fed the 5,000 with a couple of fishes and a few loaves of bread. But most oftentimes, it's through the agency of other men that the most miraculous things happen. And here we find out that it was through the agency of a man who was Melchizedek, king of Salem, which was a manifestation of God. Or more accurately, the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God, that miraculous things happened. We find out for certain that it was who it was, again, from the author of Hebrews. In chapter 7, verses 5 through 7, he verifies, in fact, that it was Christ. He says, "Verily, they that are the sons of Levi, who receive the office of priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descent is not counted from them," that of course being Christ, "received tithes of Abraham," that being Melchizedek, "and blessed him that had all the promises, and without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better." So Abraham was blessed of Christ. Christ being Melchizedek, and Melchizedek being Christ. So the author of Hebrews confirms the same, that they were both the same, Christ and Melchizedek. So that's who Abraham was talking to, and he was blessed by him. So God used the agency of God incarnate in the form of a man to work that miracle, to do a miraculous thing. And the miraculous thing was to remind Abraham that it is God is the one who needs to receive the glory for the things that get done. That it was God who allowed Abraham to be victorious, and as such, God needs to receive the glory. So the king of Sodom, standing here watching all this, knowing that all the spoils and all the people and all the spoils of war by right belong to Abraham, seeks to work a deal with Abraham and says, in verse 21, "The king of Sodom said unto Abraham, give me the persons and take the goods unto thyself." So he had already seen 10% of all the goods given away, and he says, well, he says to himself, well, I'll let Abram keep the rest of it and I'll take the people. What's Abram's response to that? Well, Abram doesn't want the goods. He doesn't want the people. He doesn't want any of it, because in doing so, it would seem then to be indebting himself to the king of Sodom. He wants to give God full glory. And so his response is to take nothing. Abram said unto the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord." And notice the term that Abram uses. It's the exact same term that Melchizedek used. "I have lifted up my hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth." So he describes God in the very same way that Melchizedek did, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. So the king of Sodom probably had his own gods, didn't he? He did. But Abram wanted to make sure that the king of Sodom knew exactly who he was talking about. It was not just any God, not a tree stump or a rock, but rather the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. He says that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich. So there's only one thing that Abram would require, that which the men had already eaten, and a share for those three that came with him who were not believers. He was not about to push his beliefs upon those three, but rather if they chose, if their consciences would allow, that they would be able to take their share of the spoils. And so verse 24, save only, Abram says, that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. So they would be able to then profit from going with Abram to rescue all the people and recover all the spoils. So, what a glorious thing Abram did. Not profiting at all, but rather deciding to give God all the glory instead. So you see then, every time we make a decision, Lot made decisions and Abram made decisions, and the decision that Abram made was to make peace. The two were butting heads. They're shepherds, you know, the people, the guy, the men who were keeping the flocks for the two, for Lot and for Abram. They were running into each other all the time and having quarrels, and it was getting contentious. And so Abram said, you know what? We need to go our own separate ways. We need to split up because the land's not big enough to support the two of us. And so Abram said to Lot, you look around and you take any direction you want. Whatever direction you go, I'll turn around and go the other way. And so Lot looked around and said, wow, this is the most beautiful way I can, you know, this is just gorgeous here. And so that's the way he went. He took the very best of the best. I mean, he could have said, you know, I'll go to this side of the river and you go to that side of the river. That would have been the most equitable solution, you know, because then you could have green grass on this side and green grass on that side too. But that wasn't the way Lot wanted to do it. He said, I'll take all the best and leave you with scrub brush and dirt. And so that's exactly what he did. He took everything for himself. And so it was a very, it was a one-sided decision and a lot of self-interest. So we make decisions in our lives, and every decision we make, everything we do, has a consequence, doesn't it, Mike? Just like you tell people downtown all the time. You make a decision, you do something, everything we do has a consequence. And sometimes those consequences can go on for years and years and years. Just like this. This didn't happen overnight. This happened a long time after Lot had made his decision to move and take that best part of the land. So you see that the results of those decisions that Lot made, you know, Lot chose Sodom and out of self-interest. And because he did that, he nearly lost everything. And he almost lost his life because of it. On the other hand, Abraham pursued peace and as a result was given victory and glorified God because of it. Lot relied on himself and was made a slave. Abraham, on the other hand, trusted in God and became a very prominent figure among his brethren. Lot had to face the consequences of his sin and his rebellion against God. Abraham, even at great personal risk, and even in spite of Lot's disregard and rebellion against Abraham, came to save Lot from all the consequences of all the things that Lot had done to him. You know, I'm sure Abram at times felt very alone in his faith and in his faithfulness to God. And oftentimes I know that we sometimes feel like if we're not the only ones, that there's just a few of us out there that are faithful, and the whole world's going to hell in a handcart, and you know that there's just that there can't be very many. You need to trust God in all circumstances. It's thinking about Elijah today, and there was a time in his life when he felt the very same way. And you can read in 1 Kings chapter 19 about the whole incident where he's looking for God and looking for a sign, and he looks in the wind and the Lord's not there, and he looks in an earthquake and the Lord's not there, he looks in the fire that passes by and the Lord's not there, and finally he hears this small voice and it says, Elijah, why are you in this cave? And he says, in 1 Kings 19, verse 14, he says, I've been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. So he thought, I'm the last one, and they're looking for me to try to kill me. And God says, go back. And he gave him some things to do. He says, go back. And here's some instructions. And he says, in verse 18, he says, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which have not kissed him. In other words, he wasn't the only one. There were still 7,000 more that had not gone astray, that had not bowed down to false idols. All that time he thought he was the only one, and he wasn't. He was hiding out in the cave. But there was lots and lots of other faithful. And at a time when Abram was leading everybody back, thinking, you know, I'm probably the only Hebrew in the whole world, who shows up but Melchizedek, king of Salem, to say, you're not the only one. God's watching and knows you're there. Give God the glory. And keep the faith. All right.